This is the session William Ferguson, Aboriginal Rebel. My name's Diane Fields. I'll be chairing the session. I'm an activist in Socialist Alternative from Sydney, and I've been involved in a lot of campaigns around Indigenous rights over the years, including at the moment being involved in FIRE in Sydney, that's Fighting and Resistance Equally, which is the group that organised this year's, and in fact last year's as well, Invasion Day protest in Sydney. Our speaker today, I should actually have to welcome you all to the conference, the last day of the conference. I know many of you have been here the whole time, but in particular about today, to encourage people to stick around to the end of the day. There's a series of other talks this afternoon, and there will be a big all-in session at the end of the day, about which I'll say a bit more after we finish the talk and discussion. Our speaker today is Gavin Stanbrook. Gavin is a member of Socialist Alternative in Sydney. He was one of the organisers and also the final speaker at the Invasion Day rally in Sydney this year, and I have to say what a massive success that was. Tens of thousands of people saying that they weren't going to call it anything other than Invasion Day and being prepared to get out on the street loudly and proudly proclaiming that fact. He also is an activist in his union, the National Tertiary Education Union, and he's also been involved in activism in solidarity with the people of Palestine. I think that one's worth mentioning today because of the gross injustice in front of us in Palestine at the moment. Okay, so I'll hand it over to Gavin. He'll speak for about half an hour or so, and then we'll have the usual plenty of time for discussion, contributions from the floor, questions, and so on. So over to you, Gavin.
First off, I just wanted to start by saying that there's a whole lot of, Aboriginal resistance, history of Aboriginal resistance that's largely hidden today. And there are a lot of resources out there online or in books, these kind of things, that are trying to uncover some of that history. I think one of the examples is Koori Web, which is a page which is organised and managed by Gary Foley. And they're basically trying to, attempt to uncover a bit of that history. William Ferguson is a part of that history, and we think that, a lot of this history should see the light of day. It's also a history of working class struggle and resistance in this country, which William Ferguson played a significant role in. The point of this talk, however, is not to claim that William Ferguson was a Marxist or a member of Socialist Alternative, for that matter. However, we do want to celebrate and show solidarity with the role that he played in these struggles. It's been 80 years since the Aboriginal-led Day of Mourning protest and conference was organised on the 26th of January 1938, one of the first ever Invasion Day protests in our history. The Day of Mourning is bound up with the life, stories and struggles of big names in Aboriginal politics, people like Pearl Gibbs, Jack Patton, William Cooper and John Kinchela, just to name a few. All of these individuals deserve an own talk, a talk about them in their own right, because of the significant role that they played in Aboriginal activism. However, today I'm just going to be talking about William Ferguson. Ferguson is known for his role as a leader in the Day of Mourning protest and for establishing branches of the Aborigines Progressive Association, which I'll now refer to as the APA, and he set those up across regional and coastal New South Wales. As well as other parts of the state. What is less known about William Ferguson is his role as a working class militant in the shearing sheds and railways for the Australian Workers' Union, or the AWU, and the impact this had on his approach to fighting for Aboriginal rights. So a bit on Ferguson's early life. William, or Bill Ferguson, was a Wiradjuri man born on the 24th of July in 1882 at Wadi, at Darlington Point in western New South Wales. He was born to a Scottish labourer, also known as William Ferguson, or Old Bill, and Emily Ferguson, who was an Aboriginal domestic worker from the region. Ferguson was raised with his six siblings in a region dominated by the pastoral industry. At the time, it was a booming sector of Australian capitalism, which relied on the mass theft of Aboriginal land in order to, produce profits. These regions were also dominated by mansions, which housed these rich land, you know, rich capitalists who owned all the pastoral regions. Ferguson was a Christian, however, he had a healthy disdain for the missionaries and clergy who brandished themselves as the white saviours for the beastly Aborigines. He rightly saw them as people who did the dirty work of the government and the Aborigines Protection Board itself. He regarded them as ineffective evangelicists because they were alienating and patronising towards the Aboriginal community. On the other hand, Ferguson drew closer to left-wing organisations through his involvement in the labour movement. He joined the Australian Labour Party and interacted with the broad Australian left, most significantly the Communist Party and the New South Wales branch, and the unions that they were affiliated to and organised in. I think to understand Ferguson's politics, we have to understand the political period that he was born in and that he was engaging in struggle in. It was a time of intense racism and class struggle. I'll deal with the racism and its relationship to Australian capitalism first. The late 1800s was a time of consolidation of Australian capitalism and the hardening of the racist policies towards Aboriginal people that came with it. It might seem a bit contradictory, but at the order of the day was assimilation and segregation. The main causes of Aboriginal oppression at this time stemmed from the bloodthirsty drive for profit that was embodied in the pastoral bosses, which could not be achieved while Aboriginal people occupied and claimed their rightful ownership of the land. Second came the vast amount of cheap labour that in many cases, or, you know, slave labour that was utilised of displaced Aboriginal people that they could be used for, to the benefit for the same pastoral bosses who stole their land. This lust for profit led to the implementation in the late 1800s of the Half-Caste Act of Victoria and Western Australia, and the Aborigines Protection Act of New South Wales and Victoria as well. New South Wales State Legislated Aborigines Protection Board was set up in 1883 to dictate most aspects of life for Aboriginal people under state control. The most rabid policies of the APB, which is as the Aboriginal Protection Board, came through the form of the Dog Act, which basically gave the state rights to uproot entire lives of Aboriginal people by force, either to confine them to reserves or to secure a cheap workforce, or both. It was a gross injustice that remained a burning motivation for William Ferguson and his political activism up until his passing in 1950. Massacres of Aboriginal people were still continuing during this period. Ferguson was already 44 years old when in 1926, two WA constables led a white mob to a region called Umbulgari in Western Australia, where they literally massacred over a dozen Aboriginal men, women and children. That massacre is now known as the Forest River Massacre. This period of intense racism and oppression was a time of consolidation of Australian capitalism. The government had a monopoly on violence which was used in the interests of the pastoral bosses. The government terrorised the Aboriginal population in order to continue to uproot them from their land and potentially profitable pastoral land that their communities sat on, most notably the communities of northwest New South Wales and northern Victoria. This push coincided with the entry into the realm of Aboriginal politics of the anthropologists. Anthropologists had always previously had some form of role in defining or determining government policy on Aboriginals. However, in this period, they will provide the key ideological framework and justification for the government's policy towards Aboriginal people. Basically, they provided the intellectual justification for extreme racism. However, this was ramped up in the 1930s, both a product of reform, which was forced onto the Aborigines Protection Board by Aboriginal resistance, and the government's attempt to capitalise on these reforms by waging arguments that suited the interests of the pastoral bosses. The most prominent of the anthropologists around the government was Professor Elkin and Caroline Kelly. They argued, to the state's delight, that because there was still culture and identity amongst Aboriginal people in New South Wales, that the state had to intensify their intervention into Aboriginal lives to assimilate Aboriginal people from what they characterised as a backward way of life. They argued for the concentration of Aboriginal communities onto small reserves, an argument which very much fit with the interests of the government, who wanted to clear land reserves of Aboriginal people and concentrate them onto small properties. Ferguson was extremely hostile to the anthropologists, once quoted as saying, we do not want anthropological studies and books about the length of our toenails and the size of our hands. You have taken everything away from us, but given us nothing in exchange. Is that right? As one of your scholars has said, you owe us not benevolence, but atonement. This intense racism only pushed Ferguson further to the left, but it wasn't the only events that shaped his politics. Ferguson also grew up in a period of massive class struggle, the great strikes of the late 1890s. They were mass struggles led by workers under intense pressure from the bosses who wanted to claw back wages and working conditions won by the unions in the period earlier. The 1890s was the first Great Depression, and as always, the bosses wanted the working class to pay for it. From the wharfies to shearers and labourers, class struggle was in the air, and Ferguson was not immune to its empowering for all. The great strike's impact on Ferguson was not only because his father worked in the shearing industry, but because Ferguson himself started working in the industry at the age of 14 in 1896, collecting and piling wool for his father and the comrades in the shed. It was in the shearing sheds that Ferguson would earn his stripes in the labour movement. He very quickly became known as an orator and agitator in the sheds of New South Wales. As Jack Horner, a Communist Party author and Aboriginal rights campaigner, once wrote of Ferguson and his father, Old Bill, the athletic Chunky Scott and his dark-skinned son, who grew like a beanstalk, tall and erect, surprising the older men with his persuasive talk. Ferguson remained in the industry with his brothers and father until he left town in the 1890s, after his father remarried. Ferguson travelled to the Western New South Wales region, moving from stockyard to shearing shed in search for work. Not much is heard from him during this period. All we really have is a few old union tags that were collected by his family that give you an idea of where he stopped on his travels. It was in 1916 that he would resurface, the same year that he joined officially the Australian Labor Party, although he had already been subscribing to their paper, the Labor Daily, for quite some time prior. The fact that Ferguson joined the ALP needs a bit of explanation. I mean, after all, you only have to look at the Labor Party today to recognise that it's a right-wing pile of shit. You know, the way it treats refugees, the way in which the Labor Party extended the Northern Territory intervention. So there needs to be a bit of explanation for that. During this period as well, it's not like it was the bastion of hope and freedom. It was the party that supported the White Australia policy. But it was linked to the working class in a way that no other major political party in this country was, through the trade union officials. For political workers, Labor had a connection through the unions to their desire to fight for a better deal. Added to that, the unions for much of this period of Ferguson's early life were both organised and militant. It must be said that the ALP has always wanted to, has always wedded to the project of running and the maintenance of Australian capitalism. And so the support given by the ALP on a parliamentary level to the struggle of Aboriginal activists and trade unions was always limited to how far the ALP was willing to push the pastoral bosses. We'll see where this ended up, a bit further as we talk about Ferguson's later life. From 1916 to the 1920s, Ferguson remained active in the labour movement. This period of engagement in class struggle is important. It was here that Ferguson honed his political leadership, developed as a trade unionist, and forged connections with others on the left. As he became more and more involved in struggle for Aboriginal rights, he used his connections with the working class organisation to further the cause for Aboriginal people, organisations such as the Communist Party of Australia. It's no surprise that the Communist Party was a significant supporter in the fight for the rights of Aboriginal people. On paper, the party stood for solidarity amongst the oppressed and exploited to overthrow capitalism. The politics of nobody can be free until all are free. The interaction between Aboriginals and communists only increased as Aboriginal people became more and more integrated into the industrial working class. Even the Communist Party and the Communist International while the Communist Party and the Communist International were in the process of Stalinization, the party continued to forge links with Aboriginal militants and activists through the trade union membership. Figures like Norman Jeffries, a Communist Party activist in the Unemployed Workers' Union, took on assignments to investigate the appalling treatment of Aboriginal people by the Aborigines Protection Board and to report on it in the Workers' Daily, the paper of the Communist Party. They would also use this organ to organise support for the cause for Aboriginal rights. The Communist Party adopted a draft program on Aborigines in 1931, which called for the equal rights for Aboriginal people, political autonomy and real land rights. In 1932, Aboriginal activists and the Communist Party-influenced unemployed workers' movement in Dubbo joined forces to protest the refusal of rations to Aboriginal people and campaigned for the abolition of the Aborigines Protection Board. Ferguson settled in Dubbo in 1933 and forged good relations with the unemployed workers' organisers. Similar alliances around similar demands in New South Wales resulted in stop works, protests and strikes, including strikes at Wallaga Lake, Menindee, Burnt Bridge, Brewarrina and Purfleet. The Communist Party would also play a significant role in drafting motions and demands in the union movement that supported the APA program in the lead up to the Day of Mourning conference and protest. They would organise for Aboriginal activists to speak in front of the trade unions and trades and labour councils and union meetings to demand solidarity, such as the adoption in 1993 of a resolution by the New South Wales Trades and Labour Council that supported Aboriginal control over tribal sanctuaries. Ferguson addressed a meeting of the New South Wales Trades Labour Council in 1937. It was after this speech that Tom Wright, a Communist Party member and the secretary of the Sheet Metal Workers Union, moved a motion calling for the New South Wales Labour Council to pledge full support for the APA and adopt, in quote, a detailed policy on Aborigines, calling for full social and political rights, award wages, full employment benefits, abolition of all indenture, and the abolition of homes on missions, as well as full representation on the Aborigines Protection Board and land rights. In the late 1930s, William Ferguson would re-found the Aborigines Progressive Association in regional New South Wales with the help of activists such as Pearl Gibbs, Jack Patton and William Cooper. The APA demands were for equal rights for equal to those of white Australians, not different rights, an immediate end to the removal of Aboriginal children, full citizenship and full citizenship rights for Aboriginal people. In other words, the same political rights, legal position and access to social services, benefits and educational opportunities as all Australians. It's worth noting that during the Great Depression of the 1930s, the Australian government just wholesale labelled most people Aboriginal because then they could deny any form of welfare services to them. Even if you like weren't black, they would say, you're black, no welfare. You know, it was a way for them to cut funding, cut their budget. The APA criticised the protectionist policies and practices of the government and rejected, at least in part, the racial assumptions upon which these were based. They attacked the discriminatory legislation and government control over Aboriginal lives and called upon the Commonwealth to take over from states and introduce a federated federal policy on Aboriginal people, or what they termed a New Deal. There were two wings of the APA, divided both regionally and politically, while continuing to cooperate. Pearl Gibbs and William Ferguson's APA was based around Dubbo and Western New South Wales communities. Politically, their support from non-Aboriginals came from the left, reflecting Ferguson's long relationship with the AWU and the Australian Labor Party and the unemployed workers' organisations, as well as their relationship with the CPA, the Communist Party. Both emphasised Aboriginal control over the Aborigines Progressive Association, yet non-Aboriginal support was crucial. This was seen in the negative when on the onset of World War II, undermined Gibbs and Ferguson's campaign as the Communist Party supported the war effort. The APA was just one of three main Aboriginal-only organisations that existed to champion the fight for black rights during this period. The main two other organisations was the Australian Aboriginal League, formed under William Cooper, and the Australian Aborigines Progressive Association, which was led by Jack Patton. The main demands of all three were to end the racist unemployment benefit system, which in most cases denied Aboriginal people any access to it throughout the Great Depression and the mass unemployment that characterised that period, and the complete abolition of the Aborigines Protection Board and the appalling conditions that Aboriginal people were forced to live under on the missions that the Protection Board controlled, or reserves. Many say that Ferguson was a separatist, considering that the APA and other organisations of the 1920s and 30s restricted full membership only to persons possessing some degree of Aboriginal blood. However, this wasn't the entirety of Ferguson's politics. His positions much more shared the general demand for equality on all fronts, regardless of race, biology, or skin colour. Non-Aboriginal people could join the APA as associate members and were eligible for elected office. Ferguson's history as a union militant meant that the organisation he led formed alliances with left-wing non-Aboriginal organisations from whom the APA demanded solidarity and received it. These alliances were important in the context of the battle that needed to be waged against the Aborigines Protection Board. The Aborigines Protection Board was the bureaucracy that implemented state government policy in relation to Aboriginal people. It was known as the Persecution Board by the Aboriginal community and was hated by most. Ferguson was the most active and outspoken dissident towards its practices, calling for its complete abolition. He said, and this is a quote, "My answer to those who will ask, what do you propose to substitute in the place of the board? The right to educate our people, full citizens' rights, and we will protect ourselves. Surely we cannot make a worse job of that than the APA has done." It wasn't just because the board represented the oppressor imposing their will on Aboriginal people, but that this process of subjugation and oppression made its mark on the Aboriginal community. From sending stolen Aboriginal children to slave driving convents or boarding homes, to missions like Cabotree Island being decimated by tuberculosis and various other preventable diseases, the APB was anything but what its title suggests. The board would appoint a mission manager and his partner to run the iron corrugated iron townships. Slum managers, I think, is a better characterisation of these people. In many cases, the government wouldn't bother to even employ managers. And what they would do is appoint the local police sergeant to run the reserves themselves, giving them the divine right to deny access to visitors, to quarantine rations, and to forcibly evict any Aboriginal person if they got too rebellious. They would label themselves the guardians for the Aborigines, in stark contrast to the yes-men that they were for the APB. Ferguson was in regular contact with Aboriginal communities terrorised by the board. One Christmas and New Year's celebration in Gilargenbone, on the Kaku Corner property, which was a place of annual gathering for the Aboriginal community in that region, Ferguson met young Aboriginal victims of the APB. They told stories of their experiences, being expelled from the communities for a policy of idleness. This idleness was, this title was given to young Aboriginal men and women to force them out of Aboriginal communities and throw them into precarious work or indentured labour. It was here that Ferguson would declare, "The board in Sydney has complete control over us and they can do anything. One day we'll have a full inquiry made into the activities of the Protection Board. I've been a member of the union since I was a young lad, picking up, and a member of the Labour Party since 1916. When I formed the Trades and Labour Council in this town, just a side note, pretty impressive that he's setting up Trades Labour Councils across like regional New South Wales, and these weren't just like skeleton organisations, they had unions affiliated to them. He then continues, "I have my faith in the Labour movement to help us. It's a workers' organisation, and we all here are workers." On the 30th of November 1937, Ferguson gave evidence to a select committee on the administration of the New South Wales Aborigines Protection Board. In it, he outlined how very clearly how he saw the connection between the racism that enabled the APB to pay Aboriginal workers a pittance for the work of which they had no choice and the interests of the working class as a whole. He said, "We now pass on to the Pilliga Mission, where the Aborigines Protection Board is working a sawmill with scab labour. Although there is an award covering that class of work, which provides over £4 a week, the Protector has men working on the mill, benchmen earning 25 shillings, tailor out 22 shillings, and others from 20 shillings downwards. I leave it to you to work out yourself how the board, by sweating those men who they are supposed to protect by the wholesale hiring out system and supplying cheap labour to wealthy squatters, are using the Aboriginal to break down the conditions of the working class." Ferguson and his comrades used the resources of the APA to investigate and report on the appalling treatment of Aboriginal people on the missions controlled by the Aborigines Protection Board. The government didn't like this, and as early as 1935, the APB central office sent out a telegram, or you know, whatever at the time, telling all of these mission managers that they needed to ensure that William Ferguson did not step a foot on their missions. Not only because they were worried about Ferguson coming in there and reporting on what's going on, but that the Aboriginal people within those communities themselves would stand up and put themselves forward to join the APA. They wanted to fight, and they were willing to stand up and do it. Prior to this, Ferguson found it easier to travel freely through New South Wales. He had always been proud of his Aboriginality, but because of his light skin, he was never directly under the control of the APB until 1936, when the powers for the Protection Board increased, and now we're allowed to make decisions and for a broader section of the Aboriginal population. In early 1937, William Ferguson travelled to Bree Warrina to investigate the board and the racist white council trying to institute segregation in the community after the APB started forcibly placing Aboriginal people on the outskirts of the town. It was in Dubbo later that year at a rally that Ferguson would declare, "They set out the charges I made against the board. I realise that we have all the best learned men and women in the world opposing our claim for freedom. For we have learned by past experience that the scholars and students will recommend that the race be preserved for scientific purposes. What a fallacy. What is there left to experiment with?" A reflection of the outrage building in Ferguson in the face of intransigence and of the government and the Protection Board. Pressure from the campaign forced the state government to set up a select committee to investigate the affairs of the APB. However, this committee was a fudge designed to demobilise dissenting pressure, and so nothing came of it. The APB had had the backing of the state in all its forms. Ferguson, now a father of 12, recognised this and saw the need to get more organised. Ferguson had previously gained support of Aboriginal activist William Bill Cooper, who had been petitioning King George V since 1935 for Aboriginal representation in federal parliament. The government was dismissive of the petition. In outrage and frustration, Cooper called a national meeting of Aboriginal activists in November 1937 to discuss the way forward. The day of mourning protest was born. The APA and supporters gathered 150 years after invasion at the Australian Hall in Sydney to demand justice, equality, and an end to the racist policies imposed on Aboriginal people by the APB. The call for the day of mourning saw a quick response from the state, and the PM contacted Ferguson to meet in discussions. The protest, of course, went ahead anyway. Tom Wright of the Metal Workers Union organised trade union support for the protest and helped draft a manifesto for the day of mourning meeting that it was issued. This manifesto was also printed. Thousands of copies were printed by the Communist Party and distributed across the country. The protest had a broader effect on the Aboriginal rights movement, inspiring one of the most significant struggles of that period, the Cummeragunga strike. I just wanted to say, before I talk about this struggle, the community of Cummeragunga were quite a political and organised community for decades prior to the Day of Mourning protest. However, during this period, I think we can definitely say that as things are shifting there's more of a feeling of empowerment to take the stand that these people did that I'm about to talk about. On the 3rd of February 1939, 200 of the 300 Aboriginal people living on the community controlled by the APB walked out to demand the sacking of the racist mission manager. His name was McQuiggan, and he was widely known for being like a disgusting, dehumanising, racist piece of crap. And so this community hated his guts with every fibre in their body. The APB claimed the walkout was because of the fault of outside agitators. The strikers decided that if they wanted to win, they needed to double down. As the strike developed, so too did the demands of the strikers. Initially, the demands were to have McQuiggan sacked and removed. However, these went further in August of that year when they demanded a royal commission into the Aborigines Protection Board and an end to the Aborigines, the APB's control of Aboriginal people and for full citizens' rights. The strike gained widespread support, mainly from Melbourne in the form of food supply collections and institutional support from the Young Communist League and some other organisations on the left, such as left-wing feminist organisations and the left unions that were affiliated to the Victoria Trades Labour Council. They also had the support from the Australian Railway Workers Union. The strike was only defeated when the New South Wales government successfully lobbied the Victorian government to withhold services and supplies to the strike camp that was based across the border in October 1939. It must be said that Ferguson did not, during this period, publicly come out and support the Cummeragunza strike. Some suggest it was because of his affiliation to certain right-wing figures within the media. However, I think it's more likely that it was because of his membership within the Labour Party, even though he was not an uncritical member. For example, there's a whole section titled Exploitation of Labour in the document that was written by Patton and Ferguson in 1938. The document was titled Aborigines Claim Citizens' Rights, a Statement for the Case for the APA. In this section, it attacked the ALP and the unions for not giving support to the efforts of Aboriginal workers in their fight against exploitation, making the perceptive point in the conclusion of that section that it was their White Australia policy has helped create the senseless prejudice against us, making us social outcasts in the land of our ancestors. So he wasn't completely uncritical of the Labour Party and their policies. The struggle of Ferguson and the APA began to bring about what many saw as progress for Aboriginal people. The APB was reformed in 1940 and given the new name of the Aborigines Welfare Board, or the AWB. However, the same racist paternalism that was embodied in the APB was carried over into the AWB. The new AWB had two positions open to Aboriginal people willing to run, and they were democratically elected spots. To the dismay of the government and other board members, Ferguson was voted in, along with Walter Page. Ferguson would remain on the board from 1944 to 1949 until he was sacked by the board, likely for being too critical of the board's policies and its lack of interest in bettering the lives of Aboriginal people. However, it wasn't too later that he was reinstated, and I don't think they would have been happy about that. The last chapter of Ferguson's life saw him break with the Labour Party. In 1949, after many disappointments, he resigned from the ALP after hearing the government continue to defend the degradation of Aboriginal people. Labor's Federal Minister for the Interior, H.V. Johnson, defended the continued use of neck chains on Aboriginal prisoners in the Northern Territory and defended unequal wages for Aboriginal pastoral workers. He left a broken man, his resignation testimony to the hopelessness of trying to arouse the conscience within the Australian Labor Party. It was not long after that Ferguson would pass away by giving a speech in 1950. To conclude, it's not the end. The legacy of William Ferguson has left is to get organised, is to demand solidarity and to keep fighting. That Aboriginal people have allies. First and foremost, those allies can be won amongst the working class. Because resignation and despair are not only the possible responses to the failures of the Australian Labor Party. Rather than accepting the limitations of capitalism, as Labor does, we need a perspective for social change that goes beyond it. The present divisions in society are not eternal. there's nothing natural about people like the misnamed protection board or the pastoral or mining bosses or any others being able to dominate the lives of Aboriginal people or the working class in general. As the government cuts back spending, it can more and more appear that the victims of the system, you know, the unemployed, migrants, Aboriginal people, single parents and so on, will have to fight each other for the crumbs that are left. There is plenty to go around, but who gets the wealth is not determined by those who produce it. We need to fight to change that. If the bosses control society, backed up by the courts, it's the bosses who control society, backed up by the courts, the police force, the army, the media, and so on, that causes and perpetuates problems like racism. Ferguson dreamed of a liberated people. That dream has not yet been met, and that is our task in the here and now.